Please note, Spring Awakening does include the subject of suicide, scenes of violence, and scenes of a sexual nature, including allusions to child abuse, all of which will be discussed in these episodes of Piece by Piece. Listener discretion is advised, and the Almeida Productions age guidance for the show was 14+. If you have been affected by any of these issues, you can find free support 24 hours a day, 365 days a year from the Samaritans. You can visit samaritans.org or call 116 123 for free. Piece by Piece, the musical theatre talk show podcast. Welcome to our episode of Spring Awakening, recorded live at the Almeida Theatre. Our guests today are Amara Okereke, Carly Sophia Davies, Laurie Kinniston, Stuart Thompson, Lynn Page and Rupert Gould. But first, please welcome your host, Joe Bunker.
Hello and welcome to Piece by Piece, the musical theatre talk show podcast. I am Joe Bunker, and as always, I'm joined by a series of incredible guests to deconstruct an iconic musical. That show is Duncan Sheik and Stephen Sater's 2006 musical, Spring Awakening. And today we are recording from the Almeida Theatre in London, where a sellout revival of Spring Awakening is currently playing. This is the first major London revival since the original London production at the Lyric Hammersmith, which transferred to the Novello Theatre in the West End in 2009, and it's fair to say it's been a hit. Kate Kellaway in The Observer described it as an evening of such unparalleled dynamism that it's left me holding superlatives up to the light, wondering which, if any, could possibly begin to live up to this production. Now, we've already brought you one Piece by Piece episode about Spring Awakening, which we recorded with the Tony and Grammy award-winning writers of the show, Stephen Sater and Duncan Sheik. If you haven't listened to that already, you can pause here and go back, or crack on with this one and listen to that later. The choice is yours. But right now, I'm joined by the director and the cast of the Almeida Revival. We are perched on the giant black steps of Miriam Buter's amazing stage design. And first up, I'm thrilled to be joined by the director of Spring Awakening. He's also the artistic director of the Almeida, and his numerous stage directing credits include Enron, King Charles III, which he also directed for TV, and Ink, which transferred from the Almeida to the West End and then to Broadway, where it picked up two Tony Awards. He's also the director of the Judy Garland biopic, Judy, starring Renee Zellweger. It's Mr. Rupert Gould. Yeah. So, Rupert, the Almeida's primarily known as a producing house for plays, not so much for musicals. Tell us why you wanted to put Spring Awakening on and how this production came about.
So, actually, my first show as artistic director here was the other musical we did, which was a version of American Psycho with the same composer as Spring Awakening, Duncan Sheik, which was a fantastic hit here at the Almeida and much less so on Broadway. And I guess that's interesting in relation to Spring Awakening, which, of course, was a huge hit on Broadway. And although loved and respected when it came to London, didn't maybe have the same length of run. And, you know, maybe in that is the innate, and I speak with much experience on this, the innate complexity of what it means to move across the Atlantic with any work, either from here to there or there to here. My relationship with Spring Awakening, I think a director called Daniel Kramer, who has worked, actually was director of the English National Opera recently, he was working for a company that I ran called Headlong back in 2008, I think, doing Angels in America. And he said, oh, there's this amazing piece, Spring Awakening, on at the Atlantic that I saw, and it's incredible, and you must see it. And I'd never seen a Broadway show at that point. I guess I was in my early 30s, and I was going over to do a show in New York. And it was the first Broadway show in a Broadway theatre I ever saw. And I got off... Anyone who's sort of had this experience where you get off a plane in New York and you feel kind of jet lagged and then immediately go and see a show is a weird thing. And you sit down and it's 2 a.m. for you. And it was an odd show to have as a first Broadway show and to watch effectively in the small hours of the morning in for your body clock. And I remember Lea Michele getting up on the chair and thinking, what is this? and I kind of, it was a blur to me and I couldn't work out how to take it and whether it was profound or teeny or gorgeous or odd or just innately American. And then I bought my wife, this is how long ago it was, the CD of the original cast recording for Christmas that year. And we really kind of fell in love with the music. And then when we went back in the spring, I think we were doing Macbeth there in New York, I actually got to know Stephen, who wrote the book, who came, and Stephen and Duncan came to see the show, our show, a few times. And so we sort of hung out together. And that was really the roots of how I came to American Psycho with Duncan. And I'd always thought, oh, I love this score. But I can see why it was challenging here for a British audience because it's sort of sound palette, that kind of pop punk, kind of Green Day-ish sort of thing that is in some of the songs anyway, was not really part of our youth music scene, I guess, in the 21st century, which I guess was more, I don't know what the word is, urban maybe, or sort of like, we didn't have that guitar sound maybe quite so much post Arctic Monkeys maybe. And and even when we did have a guitar-based sound, it always, I felt, was at its best in Britain with a kind of regionality and this sort of 19th century German expressionist piece felt an odd thing to express it in. And so I footled around while I was at the Almeida doing a number of kind of weird workshops with Lynn, our choreographer. And the first one was, I had this idea of doing it where the kids were all played by adults and the adults by kids, and I was going to try and invert the sexuality, and that didn't work at all. And then we put it to bed for a bit, and then we did some choreographic workshop. But what I did in those very early workshops, I really got a sense that the score was more, maybe more timeless and emotional than I'd appreciated, and less obviously sort of in-your-face punky. And also that the text was really rich to my ear, in idiomatic English dialects, I guess, and that taking it away from the Americana, which I think is a really big part of its success in on Broadway, is that it is a sort of high school sound in the dialogue as well as the singing, gave it a something distinctive. And then, of course, when I started meeting our fantastic cast, some of whom you're about to meet, and hearing the music, but particularly the book in English sort of regional sounds, really kind of brought it to life for me. And so even though we don't do musicals and we haven't done a revival musical, and to be honest, for a theatre like ours and the scale we're at, it's quite financially challenging to do a musical.
Yeah, I bet.
We were like, yeah, let's go for it. And so we got this incredible bunch of actors together and all set to go, great design, and then COVID hit. And, you know, we sort of limped along for months going, oh, it'll be the summer, it'll be the winter, it'll be the spring, and not knowing whether it's ever going to come. And I think now it's here. I feel like coming back from COVID, particularly for younger people maybe, is part of the enthusiasm for the response, that people want to be in a room and, you know, feel physicality and singing and energy and, you know, FU kind of attitude. I think that some of that is part of the exuberance of the response. But I guess also I was very aware that my kids are teenagers and sort of that there is a sort of politicization, I guess, of younger people. Greta Thunberg generation, I suppose, was a big influence on doing it in this political moment, what it meant to have direct action and challenge, you know, whether it's in a kind of ironic OK Boomer way or a more forceful political way, was part of the thing that infused our deeper thematic desire to do it in this moment.
And how much did you have to work to sort of make it feel contemporary? I think it does feel very much of now, and the plays from 1891 and the musicals from 2006, but was there much that you had to do, or was it all just in the piece to make it feel like it belongs in 2022?
I think it's actually in the performers. I mean, it is in the piece, but it's in the piece through the performers. I knew I didn't want to do it in modern costume, or we talked about that, obviously, and I talked about sort of setting it in a, you know, there was a high school shooting in 2019, I think, down in Florida, and one of the people shot, maybe even killed, was, they were rehearsing Spring Awakening at the time, and there's a New York Times article about what Spring Awakening as a musical meant to that generation, and of course, you know, thinking about the politics of the high school, everything from post-Columbine through to all the other social justice movements, you know, we did think about setting it now, but we felt that the piece kind of spoke for itself to something. To some extent, you've already got it. You've got 19th century Germany and German expressionism in the play, and then you've got a Broadway musical on top of that. To then add in a design, I worried it would get a bit of a soup. But I think it's sort of, I think what I remember from that night on Broadway over a decade ago was, even late at night, sort of kind of falling in love with the performers. And not just the leads, every single one. I can remember what they all looked like. I can remember their voices. I can remember the sort of the love they had for each other on stage, even though bits of it I didn't quite understand or even quite work with. I can picture them. And I think that's the thing that's special about the show, is I think you leave feeling you've sort of met these people as individuals and the characters, sure, but also the actors at some level. And I think that is also unique to musicals and singing. You sort of have a connection with the voice, and in a way that maybe in sort of pure acting you don't. If you hear someone sing, you see their soul. You can't hide when you sing, and you can't not be yourself at some level. And I think that's what I love about it, is I think the audience really respond to the lovely cast.
And the first character we meet is Vendla, who opens the show with Mama Who Bore Me, this song about how her mother has failed to teach her very vital information about life and family and how babies are made in particular. And she tries to persuade her mother, Frau Bergmann, to tell her about the birds and the bees. Frau Bergmann eventually relents to a degree and sort of lies to Vendla, saying that in order to conceive, a woman must love her husband with all her heart. And in this production, Vendla is played by the totally marvellous Amara Okereke. First up, hello, you're brilliant. Secondly, I first saw you on stage in Oklahoma, which we were talking about earlier on. You've also been Cosette in Les Miserables. This is quite a different beast. I'm interested to know how being in this show for you differs from being in a more conventional book musical or a sort of sung through mega musical. Is the process for you the same, or is it?
No, the process feels completely different for me. Initially when there was talk of this production happening, I didn't even consider it as something I could do. It was something that I thought was just not within my sort of ability, and I didn't know it that well. I just knew that it was a show with like pop punky type music. And from that, I was just like, well, that's not me, is it? Because I've just done Oklahoma and The Boyfriend. So that's not going to be me. It wasn't until I properly looked into it and read the script. And then the minute I read the script, I was like, oh, I know exactly who all of these people are. I know exactly who these people are. And more so than I could ever know a Rodgers and Hammerstein character, for example. Right. And so I was immediately drawn to it. And then I think working on it has actually helped me discover more about myself than working on anything else has.
Wow.
It just helped me discover a whole new side of myself, which I think I was kind of unwilling to discover. Mm. It's that thing of coming out of your comfort zone and then realising, like, how vast your comfort zone really can be what you're capable of. And, it gave me a new outlook on musicals as well in general, which was, like, I used to have this sort of idea of that there are, you know, specific types of musicals and everyone has specific types of casting, and you have your classic traditional musical theatre, mm-hmm. you have your modern contemporary musical theatre, and I thought those were just two different worlds.
Yeah.
I think this play, especially considering its original text came from 1890s, is a really good example of how, like, musicals have one purpose, and that is to connect to people. Mm. And as Rupert said, like, when people, especially in musicals, when people are singing and there's so much movement and there's so much happening, you connect more. That's the only way you can really, truly connect with someone that you don't know.
And it's also a really diverse sort of palette of, a musical language. And I love the fact, we actually talked, I think at one point, we asked Duncan about whether there was any sort of freedom to change the introduction to Mama Who Bore Me, like, because we were thinking about your voice and we're going, oh, could it start with a piano rather than guitar? And he said, no, this musical starts with acoustic guitar, because most musicals don't, because most musicals start big, and this one makes you lean in, and it's just that really evocative sound that you feel it in the room. And that's one of my favourite bits of the show, is watching the audience just kind of lean in, and that whatever they've been doing, looking at their programme, having a drink, they all just lean forward and they're there in this beautiful opening number.
Mama who bore me, Mama who gave me no way to handle things, who made me so sad. Mama the weeping, Mama the angels, no sleep in heaven.
Vendla, who is she, and what is nagging at her? What is she trying to express in Mama Who Bore Me?
Vendla is a very understimulated but very intelligent young girl who is being denied her rights as a young woman, I think. With all the characters, but particularly with Vendla, there's this idea that she's expected to grow up, but everyone is refusing to give her the tools to grow up. And so she's found ways to figure it out in some way, but naturally there's that urge of like, I'm never going to complete this unless you give me those tools. I need to know what to do. And so as a result of that, she kind of falls into this sort of warped understanding of what it is to grow up and what it is to experience life as a teenager, as a young woman, as someone who's blossoming. And as a result of that, she kind of finds everything out in the wrong way.
Yeah. There is another version of this show where Frau Bergman tells her the facts about life in scene one and the nothing bad happens after that.
And that's it.
It would be a much shorter version of the show.
Yep.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, Amara. In the second scene of the show, we meet the boys, Melchior, Moritz, Georg, Otto, Hanschen, and Ernst. They're reciting Virgil in their Latin class under the watch of their strict teacher, Herr Sonnenstich. And when he picks on Moritz for falling asleep in class, Melchior steps in to defend him and gets struck with a cane. And Melchior then sings about his wish to change the system in All That's Known. And our Melchior in this production is an actor who won the Best Emerging Talent Award at the Evening Standard Awards for his title role in Florian Zeller's The Sun. You might also have seen him in the movie How to Build a Girl or on TV in Dez. It's the incredible Laurie Kinnaston.
Hello.
Hi, Laurie. I still find this remarkable, but this is your first ever musical, isn't it?
It is.
How has this been? What a baptism of fire.
Yeah, it's been exactly that. It's been pretty wild. It's been very fun. As Amara was saying, I've learnt a lot about myself and the limits that you put on yourself and think, oh, well, that's not really something I can do. I can maybe sing a bit, but I never, ever imagined that I would ever do something like this, ever. And I was saying to Stuart, even, I think, yesterday, being like, you know, 3 months ago, I was terrified to sing in front of this room full of people. Because, you know, there were 12 people or 13 people who had amazing voices and these amazing directors and producers and things. I thought, there is absolutely no way I can do it. And then every night now, there's 300 people in here and you don't even think about it. You're thinking, right, how am I going to get my tie off for the next scene? And you just do it. And, like, I'm so chuffed that I've been given the opportunity to stretch a bit and learn so much about myself, really.
And you're playing opposite another brilliant actor. So Moritz is played by somebody who's not long out of drama school, but who's already clocked up credits at the Young Vic and the National Theatre. It's the prodigiously talented Stuart Thompson. Hi, Stuart.
Hi.
And this is your first professional musical, isn't it?
Yes.
You did maybe a couple at college. What surprised you about this process?
I think with every opportunity, I think, you know, especially as we're kind of finding our way at the beginning of our career, certainly for myself, you know, you want to find, as Laurie said, that opportunity to stretch to the very sort of edges, or if there are edges, of what you can do and challenge yourself and surprise yourself. And I think as you enter into a process, what I always find is the recalibration is always fun of like the, you know, the new artists that you're collaborating with, the wonderful head of the ship, you know, the director. And then also because it's a musical, you know, there's different things to contend with. So you can't kind of stay doing the same thing that you always do in an approach to a character. You kind of have to allow yourself to fall down and then go, oh, okay, I haven't come across that before. How do we, okay. And kind of patchwork quilt it. And so that's been quite nice because I think it playing such an emotional part, but also having to get the vocals out, you know, you have to balance it, so.
Yeah. Amara was talking about the comfort zone earlier on. There isn't really a comfort zone in this show, is
no,
there?
No.
No. No.
So in this scene, we meet these two young men. Tell us maybe a bit about, first of all, who is Moritz and then who's Melchior and what is the dynamic between them?
Melchior is a bright young man who comes from quite a bohemian, artsy, liberal family. He smokes cigarettes with his mum and she looks fab and wears great dresses. So he comes from that family. He basically wants to change the world. He feels as though everyone is walking around in a blindfold and only he can see the way out, which could be pretentious and annoying, but hopefully we've found a way past that.
Right.
And he basically wants change for people. And he's for the people. He is up for it. And he kind of challenges his teachers. As you say in that first scene, he tries to save Moritz by being cleverer than the teacher, which he kind of is in that way, and then gets his hand whacked by the cane, and then he breaks out to do this song about, this is who I am, I want to change it, how can nobody else see it, and you watch me and everything's going to be different.
Yeah.
I think the script in this is quite different from the 18th century script, of where he was a bit more of a predator and a bit less sympathetic with people who weren't quite like him. And I think actually we find a really nice part in that. There's all sorts that happen in that play that were much darker than we've kind of gone to here.
Because the whole classroom scene is a Stephen Sater creation that didn't exist in the original play, did it? And I think the fact that he reaches out and does a favour for his friend stops him being the kind of precocious character who you sort of, as you suggest, he might be a bit of a like, oh, shut up, mate.
Yeah, exactly.
Clever clogs.
But he and Moritz are probably best mates. They all used to hang out together when they were younger with Ilse and Wendler. They all were good pals and played pirates in their bedrooms and had a nice time, which was nice to think about. And yeah, we Moritz and I have a great old time. We go on a right journey.
Yeah.
Yeah, heaven.
But Moritz is a bit less kind of, has a bit less in the way of self-esteem.
Oh, yeah.
It's fair to say.
Not half. Yeah. I would say sort of, yeah, Moritz is sort of bottom of the pecking order, especially within the sort of, you know, just ostensibly the classroom of lads. And I think also familiarly, obviously we get to meet Melchior's mom, and she, as you say, a wonderful and liberal and a dream parent. And I think, you know, if we were to look at it within our class system, maybe Moritz's family are a few sort of pegs below. So there is that kind of fire under him that you know, he's sped on by, like, just get by, fit in, get by, do well, you know, because then you'll be able to kind of get to that land of comfort and wealth and freedom. And so I think possibly what you don't see is that motor running, the kind of analogy of the swan, the smooth on the top and the legs kicking below. I think he so desperately wants to fit in and be like everyone else. And, you know, if I don't think he even wants to be above his station, really, and do well. He just wants to pass.
Right.
He just wants to kind of be one of them, and does all he can to, and to no avail. Him and Melchior are kindred spirits in the way that they think, and especially I think in their sort of heart connection to morality and philosophy and all of that. But that is what I think holds Moritz in his place of not expressing it in the way that Melchior does,
right,
and having to sort of do it more subliminally in the way he dresses or whatever it is.
And the other significant character in this scene is one of many kind of brutal authority figures in this show, played brilliantly by Mark Lockyer. And so Herr Sonnenstich, or any of the adult characters, Rupert, I'm interested to know, did you come into this production knowing what you imagined for these authority figures, because it's multiple people played by two actors, one man and a woman. Did you have an idea in your head of what you wanted to do with them, or was it something you found during the process?
I suppose formally the roots of the Vedekind play are in the birth of Expressionism, and so initially we wanted something a bit Brechtian and kind of different and masked. And I think maybe I was a big Pink Floyd fan when I was growing up. I kind of maybe remembered those scarf cartoons and the Wall and that sort of world, which is obviously a bit like Spring Awakening. But actually, I had Mark in mind really from really early on, and because he's such a extraordinarily protean and varied actor. And in the best possible way, I would say that both he and Catherine have sort of brought loads of ideas to what they wanted to do. And what I like about their work is that it still is truthful. You know, it's like those are very real characters. They're kind of maybe extraordinarily two-dimensional at times, but they are they're really vivid sketches. And I think it's credit to Stephen's writing as well that, you know, for example, the scene between Moritz and his father is only one scene. It's only time you meet, and yet you get a whole world of family and tension and disturbance in that scene. And not just on Moritz, actually, and the father as well, however unpleasant he is. And so I think they are, and that's in the Vedekind. You get these very extraordinary scenes where I think a lot of the best plays are like this. They're not really about arcs or stories or characters. They're about scenes. Like, how much potency is there in a scene? Yeah, I guess to some extent, having two actors play all the adults means that there's generationally they're all the same at some level. And I guess the more they change, the more hats the adults wear, the more you see in contrast the authenticity of each of the young people.
Right.
And that's an interesting tension.
So Moritz tells Melchior he's been kept up all night having strange, erotic dreams. Melchior reassures him that all the boys have had similar dreams, and they sort of sing about their sexual frustration in the song, Bitch of Living. I want to talk about microphones and handheld microphones. I'm just interested, like, there's a lot of moments in the original production where every song would start with a cast member pulling a mic out of their pocket and singing, and there was a very sort of distinct line between scene and song. I mean, I know there are a couple of times in rehearsals, Rupert, where you mentioned, oh, I kind of miss the mics for this moment, like this moment kind of wants a microphone. I'm just interested, what did you always plan to not have mics, and were you always set on that decision, and what were the times when that felt problematic?
Yeah, I think, I mean, they're so iconic, the mics, the original production. I did a production of Wind in the Willows years ago, and that Alan Bennett version is written for a Revolve for the Olivier. And I was like, well, I can't do a Revolve because they did a Revolve at the Olivier. And my production just didn't work. You know, it's like the Revolve was essential. There were moments when I thought, well, the handhelds must be essential. But I think there's a pragmatic reason, which I was really keen and excited about doing a very choreographic show, and I felt they would limit the choreography too much. And I think that's a real win on this production, is that the whole body can move. But also, I felt like I wanted to chase the emotion as much as possible. And there was some sort of formal barrier about going, oh, we're now in the inner voice, which is a handheld microphone. And I felt, even though that is the way the musical is constructed, I wanted, not in a traditional book sense, that the songs would seamlessly come out of the dialogue, although that is important, but that the character would be unmediated by some sense of a single spotlight on them and a handheld come out, that you wouldn't go, oh, we're now in a different language, that somehow the language would feel more organic to how it came out of the scenes. But there are a couple of numbers, the more kind of punky numbers, where the lads have to, in particular, and the women as well, have to work quite hard to get that same rawness, like the Mama Reprise and Bitch of Living. You know, the songs are kind of written for the punch you get from a handheld, and our guys do very well.
Yeah, but it's nice. We get a little nod to that original concept in Totally Fucked when Laurie finally gets his handheld moment. But in scene three, we meet the girls. We meet Wendla, Marta, Anna, Taya, and Clara, who are travelling home after school. They spot Moritz and Melchior, and they all talk about how attractive they find Melchior. And, well, Marta fancies Moritz. You know, she's the outlier there. And they sing about their crushes in My Junk. But we also meet this sort of figure who's slightly kind of on the periphery of this social group. She's sort of in her own world, and that's Ilse. And like Stuart, this actor recently left drama school not very long ago, but you are going to be hearing a great deal more of her in the future because it's the brilliantly talented Carly Sophia Davies.
Hello.
And am I right in thinking that you guys were actually at college together?
Me and Stu?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was the year above Stu.
And were you pals?
Yeah. No, I say that like we didn't get on, but yeah, we were, for sure.
So yeah. It's just because you have an amazing chemistry on stage, and I was like, oh, I wondered if that's a complete coincidence.
I know, we've got close over this process, I think, because we're in different years. We never got the chance to get as close as we are now.
Yeah.
Like, we did get on, but it was more in passing.
And Lambda's quite big, isn't it? So it's like you kind of see people passing in the corridor and you just sort of say hi, or you see them at a party or whatever, rather than like having the chance to talk.
Well, you have a lot of time together now. Do you want to talk to us about who Ilse is?
I think Ilse's kind of incredible, really. I think when I read the script for the first time, I kind of really didn't understand her. And then I kind of read it again, and I was like, I think this person just kind of really wants to be loved. That's what I got from reading it. And she's experienced, I mean, so much. Like, I kind of read it, and I was like, how do you even begin to approach this when she's experienced, she's had the life of like a 50-year-old, you know, with the things she's experienced, like she's only 15, 16 or whatever. And she's experienced all these really terrible things, but I think she's incredibly resilient and kind of bounces back. And I kind of was really moved by that. It's been really tricky because it's like, I think when someone's experiencing those things, they don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with them. Like, when you're inside something traumatic, you don't really see it as traumatic because it's your normal. Mm. So it's been kind of tricky to almost kind of like approach that, because it's like when you're in something, you kind of disassociate. And that's kind of something that I looked into. Like, I looked into dissociative amnesia, which is a thing like when people are really traumatized, they have episodes of forgetting things, almost like complete blackouts. And it's almost like the brain's way of coping with a really difficult...
Protecting itself.
Yeah, yeah, like you kind of erase parts of your life to kind of cope with something really dark. I struggle to kind of like articulate her in a sentence.
I think you've done
really
well.
Because she's kind of like...
I think you've done it really beautifully.
So, I think she's brilliant. And I have a lot of respect
for her. And where is she living? Because she's sort of she's living,
sorry, yeah, she's living in an artist colony, but I think she's like homeless, but kind of flits to various places that she has kind of, I think, built up over the years, but is homeless.
Yeah. And what is the girls' experience of school versus the guys? Because the boys are all learning, like, Latin. It doesn't sound very exciting. It's all a lot of learning by rote, but it's sort of high-minded stuff, you know, trigonometry and so forth. Did you look into it? Like, what is the deal for the girls in that?
It's needlework and cookery, essentially. It's preparing girls to be women of that time. I think for some of the girls, it's glaringly obvious how unfair it is, or how separated we are, and it almost feels like, what is this secret that that these people are hiding from us? Because they're teaching the boys Latin, Greek, you know. I mean, there's a scene where Anna says, you know, Melchior's supposed to be the best at Latin and Greek and trigonometry, and we have a little ad lib scene that's like silent in the background, where like usually the question is like, wait, how come the boys are learning Latin, Greek and trigonometry and we're doing cookery and needlework? Like, how's that fair? And I think that's part of the draw to the boys as well, is like, what is it that you guys are doing that's so different? Like, what is this? Why are you so much smarter than us? Why do you know all these things? And what leads to that? And why are they keeping that back from us? So I feel like that's... And some of that comes out for some of the girls in just, like, a simple crush, in a simple, like, oh, he's interesting, that's interesting. Whereas I feel for Wendler specifically, it is like a, there's the key, that's a door that's open that might lead me to the things that I'm supposed to be figuring out.
Yeah, great. Oh, not great for them. Terrible. Just, yeah, a great point is what I meant. In the following scene, Moritz visits Melchior's home and Frau Gabor, who we talked a little bit about before. Moritz confesses to Melchior that he hasn't been able to sleep since reading Melchior's educational essay that he's written him about sex. And asks Melchior what sex feels like for a woman. And they in the ensemble sing Touch Me, which is a song about longing for physical intimacy, during which Moritz becomes overwhelmed and runs away, basically. First question for Stuart, I've always been interested, why does having this information mean that Moritz is even more haunted now? Because he was troubled before by not knowing anything and being innocent, and now he's been given information, but he seems even more unsettled.
I think it's the sort of problem that we all face, either at that age or at all times, of spinning lots of plates during life and having sort of macro problems of those sort of 4 a.m. thoughts of going, right, job, career, how's that going? Home, family, how's that going? Sex, love life, how's that going? And one of them all, you know, like, you know, the washing's not got done, that's fine because we're cooking this week or whatever it is. You know, one of them always slips. So I think you see his downward spiral so clearly right from the beginning, from the off. I think he's been struggling with school is what we haven't seen. And then all of a sudden he's got this to contend with. And I think it's that curiosity, that thing of going, if you could read a book of what everybody's ever said about you, would you read it? And I think he's like, yeah, go on then. And then he reads it and he's like, fuck, I was just kidding. And it's too much, because that confirms to him that he's an alien, and everything that, you know, everyone said about him, which he's fought against and fought against and fought against, has now been confirmed, because in that moment, so viscerally, he feels outside of it. And then that's confirmed even more later on, when Melchior is able to take that next step from the sort of cerebral into the physical with Wendler, which just is, you know, unthinkable for Moritz. So I think, yeah, it's the confirmation of what the world's projected onto him, and him going, they were right, fuck.
And this number feels like it's particularly pertinent. I hate to bring the C word into this, but we are, this is a show that was booked in before COVID and now we're performing it after a pandemic. So this thing about yearning for physical contact feels really sort of pressing. I don't know if that's something that, I open it to the floor. Is that something that you felt in staging or performing it?
I know. Definitely. Definitely. I feel like, especially as actors and as theatre people, we're a very tactile breed. Mm. And us having waited so long to do this production as well, when we were working on it, and it's like the first time, I think it's the first time we're all on stage together. It's so special. It's so special. It reminds you of why you love theatre people. Mm. For me, anyway, it reminded me when we were rehearsing it of why I love theatre people, because it was like, we're all in our own worlds in that number as well. We're all experiencing our own experiences, but we have this beautiful collective feeling that's like keeps you safe in that experience. And for these characters, especially for the majority of them, like Moritz or Wendler, these feelings are terrifying. They're so scary. We don't know anything about them or where they come from or why they're there. We just know that they're bad. That's it. You're not supposed to. That's it. And this idea that, like, even if they don't know that everybody else is experiencing these things, there is this collective, it's just a safety. There's a safeness there in something so terrifying.
Because it is that thing, as an adult, you can look back and go, oh, everyone was going through that same thing.
Yeah.
And at the time, everyone feels like, it's just me, I'm a freak.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, Stuart. Yeah, yeah. But actually, people just figure stuff out at different times, whether you're 12 or 15 or 18, you know, mm-hmm. everyone's...
I know like 20 people who started going to therapy just from lockdown.
Wow.
Just because like it was one of those things where they felt like, oh, I'm going crazy. There's something wrong with me. But it's like, actually, all of us just experienced something very traumatic, this pandemic.
Yeah.
So even if it feels like it's just yours because you are alone, you are in your house just with you and not able to see anyone, it's still it's a world experience. It's a collective experience, and there's a safety in that.
Something the other day about our experience of the pandemic, the difficulty of it being on and on and on. It's not like we're used to dealing with crises, and crises come and go and you deal with it and then it's relax. There's a threat, we respond to it and then we relax. And actually, because it's relentless, and I suppose that if you sort of transpose that onto the world of the play, there is a kind of constant hum of anxiety and repression, because there is no release for these young people. They're not being given information, they're not being given freedom to express themselves.
Yeah, because as you say, that feeling of anxiety is past logic. It's as though there's a tiger crouching in the room when there isn't one. And when you're saying that there's normally, you know, you're used to that pattern of, okay, crisis, deal with it, release. When there's no release, your body's in that constant state of tension.
Yeah.
Which is being a teenager too.
Yeah.
And also authorities not particularly being helpful. Something quite relatable, I think, from the characters to us in this pandemic, in that, like, we're looking to authority, expect authority to walk you through it, and they appear to be walking you through it, but you're still waiting to get that confirmation that everything's safe now, and you're never going to get it. Mm. And in the same way that these characters are, like, we're looking for guidance, and they appear to be giving us guidance, but that guidance isn't helping us in any way.
So in the next scene, Wendler and Melchior meet in the forest. They talk about how they haven't seen each other since childhood, and they philosophise about a different and brighter future. Melchior persuades Wendler to lie next to him beneath an oak tree, and they discover this attraction to each other in the song "The Word of Your Body." And also, what we were talking about earlier on about the boys and girls not being able to mix, it really resonates in this scene, because you realise, oh, they're alone, they can actually talk to each other, and it's maybe the first time that's happened since they were little tiny children. Talk to me about playing that scene. It's a beautiful moment of quiet after quite a lot of action. How has it been performing that scene for you two?
I really enjoyed that scene. It's a nice way that we kind of get to meet each other every night. And I think we both show our kind of tropes very early on about who our characters are. You know, Melchior's talking about changing the world and unless we address the growing iniquity and all these kind of very sixth form sentences. And then suddenly Wendler says one back in a much simpler way. And he goes, oh, well, that's what am I talking about? But this is really cool. I've never met a girl who can speak clever stuff. And then they're kind of like on their way. And I think it is nice that if they'd met for the first time in that scene, it would be very different. But the fact that they have been friends from when they were younger and maybe haven't seen each other properly for, I don't know, 10 years, as I say, when they used to play pirates or whatever. When he says, so what have you been up to? Like, literally, what have you been doing for the last 5 years? I don't know anything about you or what has been going on. So I enjoy meeting you and falling in love with you every night. It's great. And we, with the choreography for that song, we had a lot of different goes, didn't we, of lots of different things, and we used the steps in kind of different imaginative ways in that number. Not all of them were very easy, and I think we had quite a journey with it. But, I love that scene.
I love doing that scene. Just not with Laurie.
I love
doing that scene. I think it's really nice. It's a really nice moment where I think those two characters really get to feel not alone. Because I think Melchior is obviously quite intelligent, very intelligent, much smarter than most of the people around him, most of his peers, I suppose, and also has different perspectives given his upbringing and his parents and his home. And Wendler feels alone in that she's like, there is more to this, but nobody else seems to be seeing it. Nobody is giving me the answers, and nobody is bothered that nobody's giving us the answers. And then she hears all this stuff about Melky, he's such a radical, he doesn't believe in this, he cares about this, and he does whatever he wants. And she's like, okay, so he gets it. I need to find this out. In searching for this release that she's looking for, she's also searching for Melchior. And I think it's funny because she has this, in that scene, she does have this kind of balance of like shyness because, you know, who knows when she last spoke to a boy, and also like, you know, she fancies him probably and she's probably like a bit nervous around him. But at the same time, there's this idea of like, you're saying everything that I've been thinking and you can put it into words. You actually have the intelligence to put it into words. And so she's just in this mix of, oh, I shouldn't be here, but I need to know more. I need to find more. And then that connection just grows into like, we're on the same page here. We can do this together, I think. I think this is, you know, this is what we need. We need each other. And I think that's really, really beautiful because I feel like up until that moment, Wendler feels very alone. She feels very lonely, even amongst friends, and where everybody else is, it seems to be able to find joy in these little things. She can't find that anymore because her mind is elsewhere now. And then Melchior brings that sense of joy back, and it's like, I found you. I found you. Oh, I'm gonna be
meet on an emotional, intellectual plane and then have a relationship that moves on from there.
Yeah.
It's not just lust.
Yeah, exactly.
And also the staging of this scene, that song is kind of iconic, and that's something I spoke to choreographer Lynn Page about. So here's a little clip of my conversation with Lynn. Great. So welcome, Lynn. Lovely to see you.
Thank you. It was lovely to see you too.
And congratulations, because the movement and the choreography on Spring Awakening received such amazing responses from critics and audiences alike. You must be pleased with how it all went.
I'm really pleased that the ideas and I suppose the emotions that were sort of swimming around in my own mind for quite a long period of time did indeed communicate to people and made people feel something or think something, because I was very passionate about a lot of the subject matter, and also as a collective group of theatre makers, what we had been through the last 2 years. Mm. And absolutely what our young people had been through, and they're just in the world, but then also our young people that had been sitting for 2 years waiting for this production to start. So all those things together, I'm just pleased that I was able to channel that into some, you know, movement work, and that it was able to communicate so powerfully with audiences. So yes, I'm pleased.
So how did you go about finding a physical language for this show? Did you set out with particular things in mind, or was it something that evolved? Because, I mean, the show was delayed by 18 months, so, I mean, it must have been gestating for quite a long time. And I know you workshopped the show long before the production was actually in the calendar for the first time round. So these ideas must have been bouncing around your head for sort of 5 years. Talk to me about how that's been, and how you found the sort of language of movement that you ended up with.
I think I always saw in my mind a left of centre movement. I think Duncan's music has a huge amount of metaphor, and I think it's nuanced and it's multi-layered. And so therefore, a physical movement language that was never really on centre, that always threw the actors out of their safe zone, was where I started as a movement approach. And that was a long time ago. And then just before, then February 2020, Miriam proposed this idea of using stairs. And in my mind, I thought, I wonder if you can do sort of do the impossible. I wonder if something like stairs, which are very, very, you know, square and linear and quite difficult to move on, that if you could do something where they became fluid, and that the stairs were used in a way that, you know, water was a big metaphor for me. Water, the sort of falling in love, having emotions that are too deep, swimming in turmoil. There was just, or the metaphor of water, and therefore the stairs sort of melting away and becoming sort of otherworldly and a language that we could use, just became quite interesting to me. And also the compression and the difficulty of working on stairs. When that was proposed, I was able to sort of see movement in my mind that I wanted to try out. So there was the old ideas, which came predominantly from the music, and then add that to a very restrictive set. And actually, you know, you could only see certain things because the stairs would only allow it. But I think in the end, that's what sort of made movement, I hope, interesting.
And in particular, I love the way you use the stairs in the song The Word of Your Body, when Melchior and Wendler, their relationship is sort of blossoming, and they're discovering each other in that moment. Talk me through, or for the benefit of people who maybe didn't see the show, maybe you could just explain what happened in that number in terms of the movement, and tell us maybe how you got there.
Well, I got there because I just thought, you know, that absolute spark of a moment where, say, if you put it back to when you were young, or doesn't necessarily have to be when you're young, but, you know, you're attracted to somebody, you're interested in somebody, you feel seen by that person, you feel that you see that person, and then there's a moment where you sort of almost cross that divide and you make a physical connection. And in my mind, it was crossing the divide, or maybe if you don't, maybe just that electricity that is between two people before they have their first kiss or they first hold each other's hands. And I thought, what if you can hold that space and create movement around holding that space? So in the end, I created a duet that was about using the stairs as different kind of levels, but also never actually crossing over the line where they physically touch, that they just held that sort of space between them. And that was the start of the idea, really.
And I love that moment at the end where they end up upside down. So at the end of the song, they do finally hold hands, and as they do, they they sort of fall backwards. And mm-hmm. when you explained about the water, I'm like, oh, I can totally see that, because it did feel like they were moving with that kind of resistance through water, and they end up lying backwards.
Exactly.
Down the steps.
Exactly. And that goes back to the metaphor of water. You know, the minute you fall in love, you're all at sea. You're all at sea. The minute you fall in love, you know, your mind and your body is not your own, and you are swimming. Well, you know, or you're floating, or you're flying, or, you know, I just had this image of falling down a waterfall backwards, and the stairs became the waterfall. And so it was the metaphor of water a lot. You know, how deeply can you fall in love, or how deeply can you feel, or how deeply can you be in turmoil? And, you know, that's that. I wanted to just create that in my mind. And the stairs provided it, I guess.
I read the interview that you did with the stage, and I love what you said about working with people who are predominantly actors or singers first. I just wonder if you could maybe elaborate on that for our listeners. Why do you, as a choreographer, particularly enjoy working with people who aren't necessarily trained as dancers?
I particularly enjoy working with actors that movement isn't their, I would say, their first skill set, because if it comes from a thought and a narrative, and usually with actors that's the first place something starts from, then all of the movement is infused with a story. Two things happen. I think the movement is infused with a story, so it's really clear to communicate to the audience what the movement is about. And also, it's never that easy. Mm. I think when something is not necessarily easy, and you can see the thought and the application and the effort that goes into something, that's interesting to me.
In Act 1, Scene 6, Moritz breaks into the headmaster's office, steals his own exam paper to find out that he has, in fact, passed this exam. Huzzah. But the teachers are quite keen to get rid of him, and Fraulein Knappeldick alludes that she is going to fail Moritz on his next exam, so he will indeed get kicked out of school. Then, when we get into Act 1, Scene 7, Wendler, Marta, Anna, Thea and Clara are walking home, and Marta accidentally reveals that she is physically and probably sexually abused by her father, and shows her friends her welts on her arms. Her friends encourage her to seek help, but she refuses. She doesn't want to end up cast out like Ilse. So then Marta, joined by Ilse and Wendler, sing about the trauma they've suffered in the song The Dark I Know Well.
I don't scream.
Carly, I just wanted to talk to you about this song. We talked a bit about what dark places that you have to go to, but this song is particularly dark. Well, first up, what is Ilse and what are Marta singing about? What is The Dark I Know Well?
Those things that you've mentioned, sexual abuse, sexual assault, physical abuse, and I think they're singing about it in different ways. I think, I can't speak for Bella, but for Ilse, I think it's... she has so many different feelings about it. It's not just as simple as, oh, I don't like it. It's that thing, isn't it, of almost like it's a way for her to get love, or how she knows how to attract a man, but also maybe she doesn't like it, but maybe she does like it, maybe she feels special, but it's also kind of really scary and kind of confusing and isolating. I think it's a really complicated thing to navigate, and I don't think she quite knows how she feels about it. She feels lots of different things. And when I sing it, I wanted to sing it in a way that wasn't kind of like, this is just shit, this is awful. Because I think when people experience that, it's not just that. It's various things. And that's what makes it so complicated. That's what makes it so tricky to navigate, because there's so many different things attached to it, different feelings,
yeah.
Not just negative ones. if that makes sense.
No, totally. And in this production, Vendra is also part of this song. So usually it's written for Marta and Ilse, and then there's a male chorus that sings some BVs. But in this production, Vendra is very much present, and she sings a reprise of Mama Who Bore Me over the end of the song. Rupert, I'm interested to know why you wanted to put Vendra front and centre in that number, and how that changes or enhances the number by having her there.
Yeah, I think it's probably the number that I wrestled with most, I think, as we prepared. I imagine it's there because, it's in the Vedekind, this odd scene. And in the Vedekind, these characters turn up and out of the blue and have these very extreme backstories. I always felt like, God, this is tricky to, like, go into domestic sexual abuse storyline and have this very intense, kind of amazing, and actually kind of disturbingly cool song about a character who then we are not really going to follow that storyline through, like what happened to Marta and her father, and like there's a whole lot of unresolved endings to that, and I was sort of like, well, is that, you know, I guess, is that appropriate for a play, let alone a musical, you know? And of course the song has such power, and the character has a solo, you can't but invest in them, but then where does that storyline go? And I guess we're all, you know, since it was, you know, 15 years since it was written, you know, much more aware of certain narratives being triggering, and, you know, going into that territory being much more sensitive to the effect it might have on audience members and their own lived experience. So it was complicated. And so I said, Stephen, for me, it's much more anchored if I can imagine it from Vendler's POV, and that it is a bridge between Vendler's both deeper frustration about not knowing about sexuality, but then also this scene she's had with Melchior, which has been suddenly and abruptly curtailed by her. Like, I feel if she'd spent longer in the scene with Melchior, she didn't run off disturbed by the intensity of the feelings that are triggered in their duet together, maybe she sat with him longer. Or if she hadn't had this scene with Martha, if Martha didn't confess this story to her, then their next meeting might have been much more romantic and benign, and the disasters of the show wouldn't have happened. But there is this sort of Shakespearean kind of, like Romeo and Juliet, this chance encounter where this friend reveals this dark secret to her. And I think I was interested in the idea that she would misinterpret that as, because I think it's in the music. The music is cool, like I say, and that somehow she misreads what is an abuse story as somehow maybe a kind of inspiration or route map to what sexuality might be. In a way that I think, you know, a lot of people are concerned about how young people are exposed to pornography now, and they can come across quite extreme pornography on the internet and misinterpret that as intimacy or romance. And that then, I'm sure you'll come on to the next scene, but I wanted to find a bridge between where she was when we left her and where we come to her next, which is probably the most provocative scene in the show. And so so if it's her POV, then in a musical, you want to hear what that is. And so can we find a counter melody that sort of brings her more centrally into the story there, rather than just witnessing it from the sidelines. And your friend of mine, Joe Chisonska, came up with this beautiful way of melding the Mama reprise back into the end of the song. And so it's a slight retoggling maybe of kind of where the POV in the scene is.
Because these conversations do inevitably get quite heavy. It might be fun to do a little quiz now.
Ooh, yeah!
Harley and Laurie, you're a team. And Mara and Stuart, you're a team. Rupert, you're a team of one. Can we just check the dingers are working? So, yeah, I think we're all good. We're all set. This is fantastic. OK. So, question number one. How many adult characters do Mark Lockyer and Catherine Cusack play in total combined during the show?
I think it's 14.
Spot on. That's very impressive.
You cheated.
Number two. Name any of the original Broadway cast of Spring Awakening who went on to appear in the TV show Glee.
Lea Michele
will get you a point. And Jonathan Groff will get you a second one. Have you got any more over here?
Oh.
No.
Where's more?
Yeah, Skylar.
Skylar Astin.
Yeah, I'll give you that point. Skylar Astin, the original Georg, was in it, and Phoebe Strohl, who's the original Anna. 2 points, Timo, there. 1 point to Rupert. Number three. How many members of the current Spring Awakening cast are making their professional stage debuts in this production? Go, Stuart.
Three.
It is right. Joe Bellett and Emily. Number four. What does Sonnenstich mean, as in hair Sonnenstich?
Oh, God.
The son of a tailor?
It's a good guess. Okay, I'm going to give you some options. Okay, so is it A, sun stick, B, sun god, C, sunstroke, or D, sunscreen? I'll let you all have a guess.
Sun god.
So you're going for sun god.
Sun stick.
Sun stick.
Can I have sunstick as well?
You can, and you're all wrong. Ah. The answer is actually sunstroke. Number five, Spring Awakening, the play, was written in 1891, but only received its first performance in English in 1917, 26 years later. How many performances did it run for?
Four?
It's a good guess. It's not the one.
30? Oh, go on.
Oh,
we're going to say 10.
10 is not the one either. Do you want to have a guess, Rupert?
If I say 11, I'll give you
guys a point because it was one. It actually only had one matinee. Fun facts, the New York City Commissioner of Licenses tried to shut it down, claiming the play was pornographic in nature. And it only went on after Vatican got a Supreme Court injunction to put it on, and they played one matinee for a limited audience.
Wow.
Arguably not worth the effort. Number six, which actor in this cast began their career in Les Miserables in the West End, playing young Cosette?
Playing young Cosette.
All right, you got to answer. You buzzed in.
Asher.
Asher Banks. Absolutely right. Taya in this production. Which song title from Spring Awakening was at one time suggested by original director Michael Mayer as a possible subtitle for the show?
Totally Fucked.
Totally Fucked. It would be good. It's not the one.
The Song of Purple Summer.
Would also be good, but it's not that. It's down to you, Rupert. Can you steal the point?
Is it Bitch of a Living?
No, you're all wrong. It's The Word of Your Body. Spring Awakening, The Word of Your Body was his step.
Oh, that would be a lovely
Didn't last
title.
Long. Last few, here we go, number eight. Which song in Spring Awakening was originally written for the funeral sequence in the spot that's currently held by Left Behind? Which other song in the show was originally written for that spot?
Blue Wind?
It's good, but it's not the one.
Don't Do Sadness?
Nope.
Is that I Believe?
It is I Believe, point for Rebels. Yeah. Number nine, which member of the original London cast of Spring Awakening later played the title role of Carrie in the London revival at Southwark Playhouse in 2015?
Evie Hoskins.
Evie Hoskins, the original Taya. Very good. And finally, number 10, what does Knochenbrock mean?
Can we narrow it down to four options?
A, bonehead. B, bonebreaker. C, knuckle duster. D, dream destroyer.
I think it's bone breaker.
Yes. And you'd be absolutely right. Yeah, you get the point. Very good. So, scores on the doors at the end of that round.
I think we could be the winners.
Oh, what?
Very good. What? Team Stuart and Amara win the quiz. But a close run thing and very, very respectful.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Rupert Gould.
That's the end of Piece by Piece Spring Awakening Part 1. But don't worry, we've got more music and chat to come in Part 2. Our guests today were Amara Akereke, Carly Sophia Davies, Laurie Kinnaston, Stuart Thompson, Lynn Page and Rupert Gould, with thanks also to Priya Patel Appleby and everyone at the Almeida Theatre. Piece by Piece is devised and presented by Joe Bunker and produced and edited by Nikki Davison for Auburn Jam Music, with assistant production from Emma Maywood. Our theme music is by Ben Cox, and our executive producer is Blake Klein for Pint of Wine. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @PBP_podcast or email us with your thoughts, piecebypiecetalkshow@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to Piece by Piece. Do join us again.